This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds looking fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear leaves and debris with the 40-volt leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at the Home Depot and on homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
Our kids have said to us since we moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time for a Vault episode. This one originally published on April 9th, 2020, and it's the second part of our Bone Palace series, so we hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our episodes, The Bone Palace, where the humans are the bone lords, the bones are their houses, and we all build with bones.
That's right. Last episode, we spoke quite a bit about the use of mammoth bones by early peoples and the harsh reality of the Ice Age.
Yeah, that's right. We talked about the bone circles of the Russian plain from the last glacial maximum, where a Stone Age hunter gatherers would take mammoth bones from either scavenged or from mammoths that they had killed in hunting, and they would build these strange circular walls out of them. And it's not exactly known what all of these structures were for. We talked about a recently discovered one that yielded some especially intriguing results. We talked about what the function of these buildings could have been. Was it a dwelling? Was it a storehouse for food? Did it have some kind of symbolic or religious significance? And today we wanted to continue on that theme. We wanted to build with bones.
That's right. So it's easy, of course, to just wallow in the necromantic, gothic, and death metal glory of imagined palaces built out of bone. And certainly we enjoy doing that as well. Palaces of bone, thrones of bone, bone-forged weapons that incur 1d6 necrotic damage on a critical hit, that sort of thing. Orcus's name be praised. But to use...
or the Lord of Bones, old Rattleshirt from Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah. We'll come back to Rattleshirt in a bit. But to use bones as tools and raw materials. I mean, ultimately, it's just good sense. So first, let's consider why. So for starters, to state the obvious, bones do decay. They just decay at a much slower rate than soft tissue. It might take a decade in, say, a rainforest environment, or thousands of years in a dry environment. But decomposition still eventually occurs because we have to remember that fossils are, of course, no longer proper bones, but they have undergone mineralization.
Yeah, there are a couple of methods by which fossils are formed, but when you're looking at like dinosaur fossils, those are not the bones of the dinosaurs. They are ways that other minerals have taken the shape of the original bones.
Right. But given our short lives, it's easy to sort of fall into the loose idea that bones last and flesh does not. And any way you shake it for us vertebrates, our bones do tend to outlive us. The flesh rots away, but the bones remain. And then what are you going to do with them? Now, obviously, there's a great deal of room here for human complexity. We reflesh the bones with memory, magical thinking, and symbolism. The skull becomes a species-wide symbol for impermanence and the inexorable pull of the grave. But in congruence with this for humans, and separate entirely from it for many organisms, bones are simply durable materials of varying and novel size that can lend themselves very well to various uses. And I thought we might begin by just considering just a few quick examples from the animal world.
All right, let's do it.
So our fictional necromancers from the top of the first episode, they love a good bone pile. Any necromancer is going to love a good bone pile. And while other animals display complex emotions around death as well, burial of the dead is generally the domain of humans and Neanderthals. But there are other ways to amass a collection of bones, and that is via predation. So think of the killer rabbit in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, right?
Right, yeah.
Look at the bones.
Oh, yeah, Tim the Enchanter, the bones. Or does somebody say bones, schmones, I think?
Do they? I don't remember that part. But yeah. Certainly, this is a deadly killer organism, and as such, its place is just littered with their remains.
Yeah, this is the way in which predators and scavengers can become what's known in the fossil record as an accumulating agent that sort of gathers stuff together into a single site.
Right. And then this accumulation is often referred to as a midden. So I want to return us to a place that we've gone to many times in the podcast, and that is the world of the octopus.
Oh, yes.
The octopus midden is a great example of this, consisting of the remains of various creatures that the octopus has preyed upon. And so this includes, generally, you were talking about shells, but also it can include bones. Now, a midden like this need only be the accumulated bones of one's prey, but it can be more. The Sydney octopus, for example, Octopus tetricus, according to a 2014 paper from David Shell and Peter Godfrey Smith. Peter Godfrey Smith is the author as well of Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. They point out that this particular octopus may be engaging in a form of ecosystem engineering via their middens.
Mm.
Basically, they occur in large numbers on a shell bed of their prey, a shell bed that has ends up becoming home to a community of invertebrate grazers and scavengers, while also creating additional shelter possibilities for the octopods themselves. However, the downside seems to be that the increased fish population can then bring in sharks and make it a bit busier and more dangerous than it would normally be for these octopuses. So it's an interesting example, like kind of getting into this area of perhaps like accidental tinkering with the environment, accidental ecosystem engineering that becomes part of this this creature's habit, part of its life cycle. But then there's an unbalancing that occurs as well.
So this makes me think. So if the octopus is, let me know if I'm understanding this wrong, is the idea maybe that the octopus is using, instinctually using this pile of shells from its prey to attract other animals to the site, which can then themselves become prey?
Yeah, I believe so. Though, again, it comes with certain complications.
Right. Maybe also attracting predators. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The octopus here that we're talking about is typically solitary. But the site they observed here was just one of a couple of examples that scientists have come across of where we've seen octopods living in high-density populations with complex social behaviors.
Trash makes friends.
Yeah. But the impact of the middens here, I think, drives home how the use of bone or shell material can sort of emerge out of a creature's lifestyle. You know, like by eating a lot of creatures and then leaving their bones, you begin to create artificial environments that are composed of bones. And that opens and that changes the ecosystem, at least in pockets. Now, these are, of course, extant octopods. But what about extinct octopods? Well, there's a lot we don't know about extinct octopods because, you know, we're talking about creatures composed, of mostly soft tissue, and they are a rarity in the fossil record.
Right.
But there's one potential example, certainly a controversial hypothesis that I've brought up on the show before, and I can't help but bring it up again here. It's by paleontologist Mark McMiniman. And he and his co-authors proposed in 2011 that a peculiar arrangement of ichthyosaur bones from the Triassic period were arranged in a linear pattern by a presumed giant octopus that was playing with its food, perhaps even creating some manner of, and this is where it gets really kind of trippy and more controversial, the idea that perhaps this creature was not only arranging the bones of its prey in a novel pattern, but was engaging in some sort of self-portrait.
Okay, so I love this idea, but we should definitely acknowledge like at least two layers of pure speculation. I mean, first of all,
it is not accepted by the scientific community in any broad right. way at all.
So the first layer of speculation is just the idea that the octopus was arranging the bones like this, which that doesn't seem implausible to me, but still it's speculative. We don't know that's what happened. The second level is the intention behind the arrangement, the idea that the octopus right. was creating a portrait of its own tentacle, right? Or not tentacle, yeah. arm, sorry.
Yeah, so you know, there's no way for us to know that. It's pure speculation. I mean, and again, even the idea of this being an actual species, it's just we have a presumed, the researchers are presuming that there is an octopus here that did this because there is, again, no fossil evidence of the soft tissue that would be associated with this creature that is sometimes informally referred to as a kraken, a Triassic kraken.
Mm. Now, on the other hand, I would not say at all that it would be implausible for an octopus to mess around with the bones of its prey animals and put them in strange arrangements, because octopuses, absolutely modern octopuses, play. They play with objects all yeah. the time. They manipulate objects in ways that have no obvious practical advantage. You know, they're not just like using objects as tools or something. They apparently engage in purely recreational object manipulation.
Right. And then one can easily imagine that you have this play that's occurring with the bones. You have this, steady manipulation of the bones. And it's the thing that could, in theory, lead to more complex uses of bones later on, the use of bones as tools. Now, I don't think we see anything occurring in nature with octopods with bones like this, but we do have examples of octopods seeming to engage in tool use, say, with coconuts or shells, right?
Yeah, yeah. Using them basically as like a shield for their bodies.
Yeah. Now, other animals certainly work with bones and shells as well. Bones factor into the nesting behaviors of certain birds and pack rats. Bower birds have been known to use bones in the creation of their mating bowers. But when you think of bones as tools or bones as materials, you can't help but think of hominids and their tool and the tool use of early humans in particular, perhaps in part due to that stunning sequence that we've all seen from 2001, A Space Odyssey, right? In which a human ancestor discovers that the bone of a tapir might be used as a weapon, not stonework, but bonework. Now, I love this scene. We've talked about it on the show before. But this scene is actually a reference to the 1949 osteodontocaratic culture hypothesis, or ODK hypothesis, by Professor Raymond Dart, the man who also identified the Tong child fossil in 1924. What does that mean? The ODK hypothesis is basically bone, tooth, horn culture, osteodontocaratic culture. And the idea here is that Australopithecus africanus would have engaged in a carnivorous and sometimes cannibalistic lifestyle, augmented by bone and horn tools that they used to hunt other animals and each other. DART based this on skeletal part representation patterns at fossil sites, presenting evidence that they were possibly using bones as tools and weapons. Essentially, it's a model for the transition from ape to human via bone-assisted predation, depending on tools made from the bones of their own kills and or the kills of other predators that they have scavenged. Now, this hypothesis has met with a generally skeptical audience, and it had several notable detractors. Now, it is generally considered that ODK culture did not exist as DART envisioned it, and that the bones he observed were simply due to the natural breakup of skeletons, predator preferences, and environmental damage to skeletal remains. The criticism of the hyena is often brought up as a possible scavenger responsible for the bone middens that DART interpreted as an example of this ODK culture.
All right, so DART's picture of this extinct human relative making this tool use transition through the use of bones for wide-scale large-scale predation, that's probably not accurate. But that doesn't mean that humans never used bones as tools.
Right, yeah, and I want to drive home that ODK culture hypothesis was not like a crazy hypothesis, and it was very, very sensible. But yeah, it just doesn't seem like it's really held up over time. But still, at the same time, the use of bone tools is an important part of human tool use. There's evidence of early humans using bone tools 1.5 million years ago in what is now South Africa. And these would have been used, we believe, to dig in termite mounds. Mm. I included a photo here for you to look at them, Joe. They're the kind of thing where, if you didn't know what you were looking at, you might not get that these were tools, but these were specialized tools.
I mean, this is a huge problem in archaeology, actually. I mean, by the time we as just lay consumers of artifacts come to these artifacts, they've already been interpreted as tools. But when you're just like looking at sediments in the ground and fragments of things, it's often hard to tell what is a tool and what is not.
Yeah. Another example I came across, bone knives from North Africa dating back 90,000 years, connected with Middle Stone Age Aterian culture. And these would have been made from rib bones.
Wait, rib bones of what? Of humans or of something else?
I believe animal, but I'm not sure they really were able to figure out exactly what sort of animal. Now, according to a 2015 study from the University of Montreal, Neanderthals of the Middle Paleolithic might have made use of multi-purpose bone tools. These were found at Grotte du Bison, or Grotte du Bison, at Arcis-sur-Cure in Burgundy, France, and they would have been used alongside stone tools. So, it's not this idea of like bone or stone, but like bone and stone. And I think that makes sense, especially based in the example that we focused on for the first episode in this pair of episodes about bone technology.
Yeah, now I can think about some ways in which stone, I think, would be superior to bone for certain types of tool uses. And one of the things is that it seems there are certain types of stones that flake away in a kind of shearing pattern, which along with the technique of napping, which is where you strike stones together to try to shear off part of a target stone to make a sharp edge on it, that works with stones, but it doesn't really work with bones, at least as far as I can imagine. But that doesn't mean bones would be useless. It would just mean that you couldn't use them really to create a knife edge as effectively as you can with napping of certain types of rock.
Yeah.
Though I could be wrong about that. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So, again, this would have been a multi-purpose bone tool that the Neanderthals would have used here. So the researchers point out that, first of all, naturally, the prime purpose of hunting an animal was to obtain meat and also hide. But the bones were very useful as well. So, for example, one of the bone tools found here, the pivotal multi-tool that they're talking about here, was made from the left femur of an adult reindeer. And it was seemingly used for a few different purposes. First of all, carved sharpening of cutting edges of stone tools. So you would have used bone tools to help refine and make your stone tools.
That makes sense.
This would have also been probably used as a scraper and, quote, evidence of meat butchering and bone fracturing to extract marrow are evident on the tool. So, this would have been a very useful device. And again, I included a picture for you to see, Joe. And again, it's one of these things where if you didn't know what you're looking at, if you were not paleontologist, you might not get that what you're looking at is a multi-tool.
I was staring at it here for the longest time, trying to figure out what it looks like. I realized if you turn it sideways, it looks like an iguana head.
It looks like a horn or an ear on it. Yeah.
But that, that spike edge there. Yeah.
Now, another interesting thing about this particular study is that prehistoric experts were previously reluctant to attribute bonework tools to Neanderthals, but such finds as this from the very late 1990s and then into the 21st century changed that. I also want to point out that the Eureka Alert release on this particular study bears the amusing title, quote, "Yabba Dabba Doe, Stone Age man wasn't necessarily more advanced than the Neanderthals."
Oh my God, 10 points. That's so good. Wait. Should they have gone with the Yabba Dabba Don't? Because he was not necessarily more advanced. I don't know if that quite makes sense.
That one was probably on the table, I'm guessing. I'm just guessing. And then someone's like, oh man, what if we work Homer into this as well? Fred Flintstone and Homer in one single science press release title. This is going to be great.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we are going to discuss more about bone tools and bone technology.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
Ever wolfed down a Big Mac and thought, I could use some extra cash?
Mm-hmm.
Meet Drop, the ultimate rewards app. Earn free gift cards for getting your daily coffee or late night drive through effortlessly. Just link a card, shop, and watch rewards stack. With Drop, it's like getting paid to indulge. Download Drop now and start earning. Use the code DROP22 for $5 in points instantly.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
All right, we're back. So bone technology stands alongside stone technology as a key marker of technological and cognitive development, even if we're not putting all of our eggs in the ODK basket. So you won't really find it popping up in extant non-human animals. But how about this? You mentioned old rattle shirt earlier. You mentioned bone armor.
Yeah.
And that idea brings to mind not only old rattle shirt, but it makes me think of the Kurgan from Highlander.
Oh, yes.
Remember that bone armor that he wears, or it's like bone augmented armor?
Do the Necromongers in Chronicles of Riddick wear bone armor?
I don't remember. I mean, they certainly have some dark, gloomy, you know, necromantic aspects to their armor. I don't remember if they actually had any real bone. But certainly they would have appreciated those who wore bones. Oh, okay. Without a doubt. Another example that's really burned into my mind is the character General Cal from Willow. You saw Willow,
yes,
right?
Yes. It's been a long time, but yeah.
He was the sub-villain in that particular movie. And, of course, he was played by Pat Roach, everyone's favorite former pro wrestler, British heavy man. He was always fighting. He's been killed by Indiana Jones. He's been killed by Conan the Barbarian, all the greats. In fact, he played the sorcerer in Conan the Destroyer, that sequence.
Wait a minute. Did the sorcerer in Conan the Destroyer also have bone armor and get like a sword thrown through his head or something?
It was the scene with the mirrors.
Yeah.
Really a fantastic sequence. I can't believe I'm saying this. I really need to watch Conan the Destroyer again.
Oh, man, me too.
It does have some great scenes there.
It has a reputation for being quite bad, but we should revisit anyway.
It had a tough act to follow, for sure. But it has some pretty wonderful magic in it, as I recall. Certainly really more overt, fantasy magic than what you find in the first film.
Uh-huh. Well, anyway, this is making me wonder, bone armor, real thing? Did anybody ever actually try to wear armor made out of bones?
Well, obviously there are some problems with the idea. I mean, it would be ideal if there was a slightly larger bipedal creature that had bones and bone plates that were just already perfectly made for someone to wear as armor. I'm sure we would hunt it to extinction in no time. But I don't know. I wonder if that idea has been explored in fantasy.
That's where all the squatches went. They were hunted to extinction for their bones.
Oh, yes. The squatch skull makes such a great helm. Well, in reality, there are probably some examples you can come to where people are utilizing bone ornamentation. But in terms of using bone as like the primary material in construction, I did run across a really cool example. This is from a 3,900-year-old suit of bone armor that was unearthed in Omsk, Siberia in 2014. And in this example, and I encourage anyone to look up an example of this, you'll find a picture if you just look for bone armor Omsk. That's O-M-S-K. In this example, what we have is basically a shirt of plate mail, but with each individual plate carved from animal bone. And, it reminds me, too, of the sort of the ceremonial jade armor that you see used in Chinese culture, where nobody's wearing like the big obvious bones of a creature, but you have all of these little plates of bone that are then stitched into this garment that is worn by the warrior. And this would have been worn, the researchers point out, by a very specialized warrior, a hero, if you will.
A prince of the universe, if you will.
Yes.
Wait, do we know exactly what the pros and cons of this type of armor would have been if it involved bone? How does that compare to standard materials? Do we know anything about that?
Its durability?
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is something we need to explore in a future, like full-on look at armor, which is something we've been talking about wanting to do for a while. But I mean, basically, we do see so many different approaches to armor in different cultures, depending on available resources. We've discussed in the past the Inca and how Inca armor depended so heavily on fiber. And it was apparently quite effective in their engagements. Certainly, you get into cultures that have more access to various metalworking strategies. You see the metal armor. This seems to make sense, though, because you would have a durable material that would augment whatever hide based armor you're creating. But it's going to be lighter than using little bits of stone. It's going to be lighter than weighing yourself down with this with an enormous stone garment. So I think it's just going to come down to material availability.
Now, you said this was unearthed in Omsk in Siberia. I wonder, would the people living in this region have had access to many other types of resources to make armor out of, or would it be closer to like the bone house in the Ice Age situation, where basically this is what you got?
Yeah, I feel like resource availability is one of the key aspects of this, and this would have been this would have been Bronze Age technology, basically. The article I was reading about this from the Siberian Times titled Warriors 3,900-year-old suit of bone armor unearthed in Omsk from September 6, 2014. They mentioned that at the time, the individual using this armor and also the individuals they would have battled, you would have found the weapons at the time consisting of bone and stone arrowheads, but also bronze knives, spears tipped with bronze, and bronze axes.
Okay.
And they contend that this sort of armor would have held up reasonably well against the armors of the time. And therefore, this would have been like a very precious suit. This would have been high end. Again, the stuff a true hero would wear.
And not just for decorative reasons, actually, like for functional reasons.
Yeah, they seem to think that this would have been functional. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm getting some.
the artistic interpretation looks rather cool, rather stylish. You know, it's not rattle shirt. It's not nearly as intimidating in terms of looking like you're just covered in bones, but it has used the bone as a raw material for their technology.
All right. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
Tired of wandering the aisles at Walgreens trying to find the best deals? Well, we've got something that'll make your shopping experience a whole lot sweeter. Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you with free gift cards just for doing your everyday shopping. Whether it's groceries, toiletries, or your favorite snacks. With Drop, every purchase earns you points towards fantastic rewards. Download the Drop app now. Use code DROP55 when you sign up to get $5 in points.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
And we're back.
So earlier we talked about octopods creating their bone middens and in doing so remaking the local ecosystem. And I have an example here that that is really interesting that I ran across concerning humans doing much the same way. In 2016, researchers from the University of Georgia discussed how native peoples in southwest Florida, known as the Calusa, engaged in landscape engineering, quote, essentially terraforming, according to study lead and University of Georgia anthropologist Victor Thompson.
All right. So how would this work?
Okay. So we're dealing with fisher, gatherer, hunter people here. You know, they're depending a lot on gathering up, and hunting creatures that live in and around the water. So what they would have done is they would have piled their accumulated shells, all the shells of the creatures that they've scavenged and, for food already. They would put these in massive heaps to construct water-bound towns.
Whoa.
Essentially, artificial islands. Hundreds of millions of shells would have ultimately been required to produce these islands.
Wow.
But again, it's very much in keeping with sort of what those octopods are doing, and also ties back to what we were talking about with the mammoths early on. Like, you're accumulating these leftovers, these remnants, these hard materials that are the results of your lifestyle. And then you put all that together, that's a lot of material. You can start doing things with it. You can build some sort of a small palace out of them, or you can heap them together, add mud and other materials, and essentially start remaking the landscape that you live in.
Yeah, letting these inedible animal products not just become trash, but become building materials, become tools, become a way of shaping your world.
Now, in terms of other bone structures in human culture, you'll find various examples of this as well. Various crypts and ossuaries come to mind. You know, bone houses that at times have, say, walls or structures that are decorated with bones, if not made of bones. And Stuff to Blow Your Mind actually has an older episode about ossuaries that I would refer listeners to. This is one I did with Julie Douglas several years ago. But one of the more amusing and less gloomy examples of this sort of thing that I came across is the fossil bone cabin in Medicine Bow, Wyoming, which you absolutely should look up a picture of. There's an Atlas Obscura article about it as well. And it is this, at first it just looks like a rock little house, you know, nothing too gloomy, nothing too weird, but it's just standing out in the middle of nowhere with this kind of like wasteland landscape around it. And it has a sign out front, at least when this picture was taken, that says, "Believe it or not." And this cabin is itself only about 80 years old, but it's built using rock that contains fossilized dinosaur bone fragments.
Wow.
So essentially, it is a dinosaur bone house out in the middle of Wyoming.
I'm going to be the Indiana Jones of this house. This belongs in a museum.
Yeah. You know, Joe, we don't have any live shows coming up, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. If we could book this location for a live show, I would do it. Maybe we only have like one Wyoming listener out there that could possibly come, but it would still be worth it to record in the Believe It or Not fossil dinosaur cabin.
Wyoming mind blowers out there, chime in. Let us know you exist. Tell us. Contact at stufftoblowyourmind.com. If enough of you let us know, we'll try to see if we can do a show from the roof.
All right, we're beginning to reach the end here, but Joe, I understand you have one more gnarly bone palace denizen to discuss with us here.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about other species that practice something like the prehistoric bone lords, the Russian plain, and I came across evidence of a marvelous wasp species that I think would have had a real affinity for the mammoth bone houses. This animal lives in southeast China, and it's known as Deuterogynia ossarium. You can probably hear in the second part of its species name, ossarium, that it's named after the ossuaries, right? The human bone houses where bones are stored or sometimes used in construction. And this is also known, this animal is known as now the bone house wasp. Now, the use of the word bone there might be a little misleading because while this wasp absolutely does practice corpse architecture, its bricks are not the bones of mammals, but the crumpled exoskeletons of ants. And I got to give credit to Gwyn Pearson writing for Wired for one of the best article leads I've ever read. So she's writing an article about this animal, and she starts with a quote from Conan the Barbarian. You know that scene where the general asks Conan what is best in life, and Conan says, of course, to crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and hear the lamentations of the women. And yes, they all laugh, you know, ha ha, that is good. But Pearson goes on to say a newly described wasp species would disagree. What is best in life is to feed your children living spiders and build a wall around your nursery in which you've entombed the body bodies of giant ants. I think that's a pretty good point of comparison, because it's like the same way that the general riding out over the steppe, you know, must project strength in order to, in his mind, protect his own clan. This female wasp that builds this nest out of dead insects is also doing it in a way from a place of love.
Yeah, this is a wonderful organism. If memory serves, I did a monster blog post about them back when we had blogs. I did one comparing this
good
species.
Old days.
Yeah, I did one comparing this species to the creeper from the Jeepers Creepers movie.
Oh, okay.
Which is another entity that like builds stuff out of dead things. Oh, really, I guess kind of a common trope, or at least not an uncommon trope in the world of fictional monsters. But here we have the real deal, the natural world example.
This was the only example that I could really find of this being done with insects. Maybe there's another one, but I didn't come across it. So this species and its unique nest building strategy was described in a 2014 paper in PLOS1 by Michael Staub, Michael Ohl, Chaodong Zhu, and Alexandra Maria Klein. And the paper was called A Unique Nest Protection Strategy in a New Species of Spider Wasp. So the species was found and described during a biodiversity survey in the forests of Jiangxi province. And so the bonehouse wasp is a pompilid, which is a family of spider hunting wasps. This also includes the famous tarantula hawk. And there are a bunch of different species of pompilids, but most are pretty similar in their basic survival and reproduction strategy. A lot of times the adults on their own would seem to be fairly peaceful. A lot of them are, you know, sort of vegetarian nectar feeders. But when it's time to reproduce and provide for the next generation, that's when the true horror comes in. So they tend to be solitary rather than living in colonies like so many other bees and wasps. And the standard predatory reproductive strategy is that a female wasp, a female pompilid, will find a spider and then sting the spider, and the sting will paralyze it, and it will drag the still alive but paralyzed spider back to a nearby nest and then lay an egg, usually a single egg, on the spider's body, often like sort of on the abdomen. And then it will seal the spider up in this cask of Amontillado style live burial. And then the egg hatches and the larva begins to eat the spider slowly inside out as it grows, often saving the most vital internal organs for last.
Man, I love wasps. I actually wrote How Wasps Work for How Stuff Works years and years ago. And I remember that was one of the features, one of the many features about wasps in general that I love is that, that adult solitary wasps mostly feed on nectar, but then they spend most of their time foraging food for their carnivorous younglings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes me think like the human analogy would be like an adult who is vegan, but they also are like hunting animals for their babies to like eat while they're still alive.
Yeah. Baby needs meat. Baby needs living meat in the nursery.
But the hunt entirely powered by blueberry smoothies.
Yes.
So what makes this bonehouse wasp different from the other pompilids is the strategy that it uses to protect the nest where its larva gets sealed in with its food source. And so the basic idea here is that the nest will have a vestibular cell, or sort of like an outer cell area, where the adult wasp will pack in the dead bodies of ants. And so the nests of the species, the researchers found, were less vulnerable to attacks than the nests of other similar wasps. And this would seem to suggest that the dead ants play a role in repelling predators or parasites from the nest, likely through chemical cues, smells, right? So there's something about these ants that, you know, even when they're dead, they give off this smell like, oh, that's something I don't want to mess with, and the predators will go away. Because, I mean, an ant colony can be a formidable adversary.
You know, this also reminds me of another group of famous cinematic corpse defilers, the Chainsaw Family from Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Sure.
Because what do they do with the various bones and fragments that they have left over? They hang from the trees, right, surrounding the compound, almost to warn people away, except for, of course, the meddling teenagers that are central to the plot.
Well, I mean, it makes me think back to the to the Bone Lords, the prehistoric peoples of the Russian plain. Mm-hmm. Obviously, again, there is no direct evidence whatsoever that the bones that they built these rings out of were in any way to repel predators. But now I'm just trying to imagine for a second, could it play any kind of role like that? Could there be some significance we're not imagining where this is? Maybe it gives off a stink like a carnivore's den or something. I don't know. Pure guesswork. I mean, I guess any kind of benefit you'd get like that, you'd probably also get. Concurrent downsides of stinking like meat and attracting carnivores in the process.
Yeah, but you can easily see with this wasp example how like this is the sort of thing that would likely emerge out of just the keeping of a midden. You know, like the leftovers of these meals are around and or in the nest, and then in some cases they can come to have a key benefit. They can offer a key benefit to the nest itself.
Okay, so if you were going to play this strategy and try to plant something around your house to keep people out that worked on the basis of smell, what would it be? What would repel everything and attract nothing?
Oh, I mean, there are plenty of grisly examples, but you know, an actual real life example, and this is completely ridiculous, but there have been times where I've been working on my laptop, on my front porch, and once the mosquitoes are active, I'll kill a mosquito. And there'll be this weird idea that I should leave the corpse of the mosquito out where the others can see it as a warning, you know, that they shouldn't mess with me because I will kill them. They're not going to be fast enough. But of course, that's just ludicrous on my part. But there's like some sort of weird instinct to do that, to make an example out of the creature that is hunting me.
Yeah, I would say it probably works to the opposite effect. You've created a martyr and now they must avenge their fallen sister.
Yeah, there's that. Yeah, there is that. But in terms of like actually, yeah, I don't know, hanging skulls outside my home. I mean, around Halloween, we all do that. But that actually has the opposite effect.
That draws people in.
Attract people in. Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, going back to that first episode about the bone circles, I mean, some of the hypotheses offered do seem interesting, but I've still got this mystery banging around in my head. I'm not going to forget about this.
Yeah, it's one of those that really forces you to think long and hard about who our ancestors were and what was important to them in this time of great trial. All right. So there you have it. A second dose of the Bone Palace. More examples of bone technology, bone collection, and the remaking of our world with the remnants of those that came before. In the meantime, if you want to check out other grisly episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you will find them wherever you find our podcast. And you can find us just about anywhere. If you go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, that will shoot you over to the iHeart listing for our show, and you can of course subscribe and listen there as well.
Huge thanks as always to our amazing audio producer Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, to let us know you listen and you listen from Wyoming, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota #4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
Constantly making trips to Home Depot? Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you for every shopping trip. Earn free gift cards for shopping. Download the Drop app now and use code DROP33 to get $5 in points.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like.
Whoa.
And. Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.